I don't know how to exactly get ready.
Well, I think you've been preparing for this moment probably your whole life. Not to put too much of a spin on it. Are we rolling?
Oh, yes. This
we're rolling. This is Michael Klein. We're in the, what do they call this? The
development
office of the Concord Free Public Library. And we are with the Blodgetts. And maybe you'd begin, if you would, tell me your name. Say mine. I'll hold this. Thank you. My name is?
My name is Rebecca Blodgett. People,
and your date of birth, please?
My date of birth was April 16th,
1933. And I'm Timothy Blodgett, and I was born on August 13th, 1929.
29. You, both of you are amazing. I never would have guessed you'd been around as long as you have.
Yeah.
That's great. So tell us a little bit about your early years and particularly about your path to Concord if you weren't born here.
I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota. My parents, Helen and John Driscoll, I was the firstborn child for Helen and John Driscoll. My mother moved to Concord, Mass, when she was a year old from Watertown, where she was born,
Watertown, Mass.
And she grew up at the Middlesex School, where my grandfather, Charles Locke, was a teacher. And he taught Latin and coached the crew. So my ties with Concord began when I was quite young. I heard a great deal about Concord, and we traveled here to visit our my grandparents. And so that's the beginning. I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota, and used to come east to go to Cape Cod in the summer, where the extended family, that there was an extended family vacation house in South Orleans. And every time we came, as I said, we did visit Concord. I also had two uncles who ran a store here for, well, an aunt and uncle and that uncle's twin brother.
And their names?
Their names were...
Bill
and Andy Locke, William and Andrew Locke, and Mary Locke, whose father had started the Concord Country Store. And his name was Franklin Trumbull. He lived in Weston, I think. At any rate, we used to get Christmas presents from the Concord Country Store. And
what did you get?
Well, they had, I think they had the first preppy clothes. Shirts, plaid viella shirts, which were warm, is what I used to get from the Concord Country Store, or cotton plaid shirts.
Penny candy, too.
When we visited here, we always liked to go to the penny candy section of the Concord Country Store. They had a notable section. I actually moved to Concord with my husband, Timothy, in 1968. We had been living in St. Paul. Tim worked for the Minneapolis Star and Tribune as a business editor, and he heard about a job at Harvard, the Harvard Business School. Excuse me. Well, it was the Harvard Business Review, which was sort of under the wing, I think, of the Harvard Business School.
The journal?
The journal. Academic. It was a bimonthly journal. Mm-hmm. And so we packed up our station wagon and four lively children and drove east. Naturally, I had set my sights on Concord. I like to be near family, so, and I had aunts and uncles here and cousins. When we arrived, we found that the prices in Concord were a little steep, so our first house was a rental in Acton, right next door to Concord. We were there for,
two and a half years.
And then bought a house in the center of Concord and on Hubbard Street, about two blocks from the library, which was one of the delights for us of living in Concord. And we've been here, lived here ever since. Raised four children here, and we've been affiliated with the First Parish Church, Unitarian Universalist Church in town. I spent some time as a minister of pastoral care at the First Parish, and it's been sort of an important institution in our lives. We've both had leadership positions there, and been involved in a number of other things in town.
So your root system runs pretty deep, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Mm-hmm. Run pretty deep. I also had a great aunt who lived here, and two of her children married into the Emerson family, who were descended from Ralph Waldo Emerson. And so there were lots of connections with Concord, it seems.
And you, sir?
Well, I was born also in St. Paul and
in
1929, and came east to college, and then went into the service during the Korean War, and got out and went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota and met Becky, and we married and moved to Worcester, Mass. I was a reporter on the evening paper there for 2 years, and then back to Minnesota, and I was a reporter and editor on the Minneapolis Star and Tribune for 8 years. And then in 1966, as Becky mentioned, we came east when I took a job as an associate editor at the Harvard Business Review. And eventually, as she said, we landed in Concord, and we bought a house short distance from here and in 1968, and after some work on the house, we moved in February of 1969, and I continued at the Harvard Business Review until I left in the early 90s. And when shortly after we moved here, a cousin of mine said, "You have antecedents here," and so she sent us some information, including a genealogy layout, and turned out that among the ancestors were the founders of the town, Reverend Peter Bulkley and Simon Willard and others.
Those are your antecedents?
Yeah, those are my antecedents.
They were all there. But
that was all accidental. And then a maiden cousin of mine who heard of that we were moved had sent us a silver porringer, which was made by a silversmith named Bartlett back in 1795. So Lucy Bartlett was born in...
Oh, she was born in 75.
She was born in 75 and married in 79. This porringer was made in town by Samuel Bartlett for Lucy Hubbard, my ancestor, when she was married. So our connections with Concord go back pretty far, although it was accidental, really, on my part, that we moved here.
To, Could I add something here? Tim did donate this porringer to the Concord Museum, and they were extremely interested in it and had been going to look in the market for a silver porringer made by Samuel Bartlett?
I forget.
Well, yeah. Anyway, the silversmith.
They didn't have anything that was made by him in the 10 years he lived here and worked as
they
a silversmith.
They were quite thrilled to get
they
it.
They were happy to get it.
And so it sits in the museum and sometimes is on display. And before that, we had it in our house. And then there seemed to be a number of robberies in town, daylight robberies. And silver was one of the things they were after. And we got scared that the porringer might disappear. We put it in the bank for a while, and that wasn't really a very nice place to have it. And so we were delighted to donate
give it to the museum.
Donate it to the museum.
Yeah. You felt it would be secure there.
Yes.
Yes. They take good care of it there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So. Tim has a very complete genealogical record of his family in
but you Concord. Hadn't sort of realized that?
No, I had. My parents were not interested in genealogy. Well, my mother was, but this is descended from my father, and he had no interest. So it was his cousin on my father's side who let us know that we had. That I had antecedents in Concord after we moved here. Yeah,
that's putting it mildly, really, because it's a list of all of the important people who settled this town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway,
so what did that mean to you to find that out after you'd gotten here? What did that do to your relationship with the town?
Well, it didn't really matter, except that it's nice to know that. I have roots here going way back. Yeah. The minister, this is a little anecdote, the late minister of our church, First Parish, found out about this, and there's a portrait of Reverend Peter Bulkley in the church. And
who was the first minister in the church?
The first minister, yeah, 1635. And, well, they're co-ministers then, but the other one left. Anyway, he'd be... talking to somebody and wanted to move on and finish the conversation, and he more than once spotted me and said, "Oh, here's Tim Blodgett. He's descended from Peter Bulkley, whose picture is right there." So Dana Greeley would get rid of the person he was talking to, and I would be
stuck.
Yeah, right. So. So that was one.
You became the link.
One way I'd be recognized. Yeah.
What does one say after that?
Yeah. So.
So, this job of yours with
the Harvard Business
Harvard
Review.
Harvard Business Review must have been very consuming. Was it? Or did you have energy to put into the?
Well, most of the work was editing work of other people, which was really creative because often the material wasn't very good and wasn't. Well presented or well organized, and so I enjoyed the editing very much, and I wrote quite a few articles too over the 25 years I was there, and it was very rewarding work. The office politics were not rewarding, but those were a drag. But I enjoyed the work itself very much, and I still edit my children's.
One thing that was nice about Concord was that there was a train a block and a half from our house, a commuter train, and we only had one car for many years, and we could pop right onto the train. And
yeah, 5-minute walk, and I was on the train. I'd read a book and get off in North Cambridge and walk to the office about a mile or so from there. So that was a good way to commute, avoid all the traffic.
Yeah.
Car traffic.
Did you work on the train?
No, I didn't do any work on the train. I avoided that unless there was something that just had to be done before I got to the office, but that wasn't We were a bi-monthly, and deadlines were not like newspaper deadlines. They weren't sitting on your shoulder.
You read books on the train.
I read many, many books on the train. I purposely avoided playing cards with other passengers, with friends, and reading the newspapers. I read books.
What were your perceptions of Concord when he came here as a resident, and how have those changed over the years?
Well, Concord was a much quieter place then in 1968, when we bought the house. Smaller and quieter, and pretty much of a patrician place. Now it's filled with younger people, and there's a lot more wealth in the town. There was a fair amount of inherited wealth when we moved here, but not much nouveau riche kind of wealth. And the town has become a lot busier, a lot more going on. It's pretty quiet when we moved here. There was a little, on the main street, there was a little supermarket. And, there was a, let's see, what else was there? There was a Woolworths right around the corner, too.
There was a much greater variety of stores in because now we have a lot of boutiques.
Yeah.
Boutique clothing stores.
Upscale stuff.
But we had a store where you could buy linens downtown.
And there was a paint shop, too. The paint pot. Yeah.
The paint pot had art supplies. Yeah. And there was a 5 and 10 where you could buy, you know, goldfish and take the moment a little.
All within walking distance.
All within walking distance for us.
One great thing
was
about
wonderful.
Where we lived is could walk easily to downtown in just a few minutes.
Now, I'd say it's limited. What you can buy downtown is very limited compared with then. There was, of course, a bookstore, as there still is, and we're extremely interested in seeing the bookstore survive. Tim buys a lot of books from them and helps the cause. I think Concord was a small town, a sort of self-sufficient town, in a way. I mean by that it wasn't. Did not seem to be at all a bedroom town, a suburb, a commuter town. Though there were people commuting, of course, then.
Yeah, like me.
Today it seems much more. I think it is probably considered a suburb of Boston. And that's. So. I think it's a faster paced place, more high power. I think it's more high powered or something. It's hard to put words to it, but it's more sophisticated. In a worldly way. I mean,
you're doing great. Just keep up. Just keep struggling.
I don't have facts to back this up, but it's my perception that
your perception,
and that it's a very desirable place for people who are CEOs of companies or. And it's a place where people like to escape, I think. Notice where people with prominent jobs, there are some here who like to sort of hide out in Concord. So.
I think there's a good deal less economic diversity than there used to be.
More wealth,
policemen and firemen used to be able to afford to live here, but they can't.
I think that's
now,
definitely true.
For instance, mm-hmm. And actually, there is a fund in town, run by the selectmen, actually, or seen by a selectman, whereas where people like us can contribute to a fund, and which would help out people with their taxes who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford to live here. I don't know how much the fund amounts to, but we give to it every year.
I think it's much
too
more
bad that is necessary. Mm. But
the high price of housing probably makes Concord more exclusive than it used to be.
Were you aware of that happening, or did you wake up one day and just find it was real different, or what? How do you describe that?
I don't think you wake up one day. I think it's a gradual process, and something makes you think about it.
Well, you hear, about the you changes. Hear about the prices of houses that have been sold, and that's certainly a clue. And our house went for about 10 times more when we sold it as when we bought it. Of course, we did add a good deal to it. Not 10 times, but...
it wouldn't surprise you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was more than 10 times.
It was more than 10 times.
It was more than 10 times. And so it's too bad, but that's the way that some towns like ours go. It becomes a very desirable place to live. The school system, public school system, is good.
It has a very good reputation.
Yeah.
High school does.
Yeah. So.
Though there are plenty of people here who send children to private schools. My family members, my aunts, my mother, my aunts, and uncles went to Middlesex and Concord Academy. I think there was no tuition for the girls to go to Concord Academy because my grandfather taught at Middlesex. I think there was a reciprocal waiving of tuition for the teachers in probably both schools. And so they were able to have the benefit of a, you know, pretty good education without being wealthy at all. I mean, without having the money to pay for private school, which is kind of interesting.
So, culturally, was it an artistic place to live, would you say?
Artistic.
Community arts, artists, traditions of art.
Much more so now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Than it was then. It didn't stand out as being a place where the arts were flourishing particularly. But there was a tradition of some good music here. There was a summer school, the Surrett School of Music, that was started by a Harvard professor of music in the music department at Harvard to train young people to teach music to elementary school age children and middle school age children. There hadn't been music in the schools, I think. My mother was musical. My grandfather was musical. He had a beautiful singing voice. And mother took piano lessons, and then she spent one summer at the Surrett School.
Teaching?
No, as a student. And then later on, she taught music in a lower school, in an elementary school.
What year or what decade would that have been that your mother?
Well, it would have been in the... She was born in 1910, so it would have been in the 1920s that this happened. The library has a collection of music, I think, from the school. They developed a series of graded songbooks, which I have a copy of from kindergarten, first through third grade, and then one larger book of sort of general folk songs and whatnot. I don't know how how wide the influence of this was, but I know my mother took it with her to St. Paul, and taught, I'd never really
did
looked.
Did she teach you those songs?
Yes, because she played them on the piano, and we sang them,
the
and
evening.
She sang them to us. Well, yes, she sang them to us when we were growing up. The sort of kindergarten song. There was a lot of fun. The songbooks were really based on folk songs, I think, English folk songs particularly, and were a lot of fun. And I used them with my own children, played songs.
Well, then in the Unitarian Church, there was a strong tradition of singing also, was there?
Yes. Yes, my grandfather sang in the choir, and he was a soloist, I think, at not just the Unitarian. It was then just Unitarian. Now it's Unitarian Universalist. And he would be a soloist at the Episcopal Church sometimes, and he would also travel around in Massachusetts doing solo work. And he also sang with the Handel Haydn Society. He was right in on the beginning of the formation of that group. It's a choral group in Boston, mm-hmm. which still goes.
He must have been terrific.
He had a very beautiful bass baritone solo voice.
I just thought of one little anecdote, which to a certain extent indicates the differences between Concord then and Concord now in terms of sophistication simplicity, perhaps. A dentist in town named John Boynton, who was our dentist for a while, helped form the Concord Orchestra, which is an amateur group which still operates. And the violin section used to prepare rehearsals at various people's houses, including John's, and then they go back in the kitchen and have cocoa or coffee or whatever. So he played in the Concord Orchestra for several years and then stopped. And then later on, he decided to resume his violin playing. So he applied to the Concord Orchestra and found out that you just couldn't join, you had to audition. In the meantime, they had gotten a director who was very professional, still is director of the orchestra, and he found out that he just couldn't audition because he wasn't good enough. And so he was rather bitter about that, he told me, because he thought that an orchestra should be open to everybody, but it was a sign of the, not professionalism, but advanced demands for good music that somebody like John Boynton was cast
aside.
Capricious and arbitrary standards, perhaps. But it's a it's a very good amateur group. We have season tickets to it, and
we've supported that group.
We supported it
since we moved
for many years. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's one indication of how simple and gentle things were at one point, mm-hmm. that they've changed along with Concord since.
That's a good example. Yeah.
Now we have a portrait. I have a portrait of my mother hanging in our house. She used to go down the road from where they lived at Middlesex School, and there was an artist named Alice Sawyer, S-O-H-I-E-R. And she was one of the people who helped to begin the Concord Art Association in the 1920s sometime. And she would, I think she practiced on my mother. There are several portraits which we've been lucky enough to one was found by an aunt of mine, and the other one had been given to mother. And she was quite talented. She had studied at the Museum School in Boston. And it's a fun portrait. We hadn't paid much attention to the Art Association until about
15
or so years ago, mm-hmm. when someone approached us. They were raising money to enhance the space and create some new spaces inside, and we did donate, make a substantial donation to that, because it felt like a wonderful old building that we wanted to see restored. And but it made me think about the connection between the portrait I had and one of the founders of the Art Association and my mother, who I think she was just, she had a very attractive face, and she made a good model. And I think she was only 16 when she sat for this portrait. So there are a lot of ways in which we feel very deeply connected with Concord, which happened before we came here. It's been kind of a surprise, in a way, to discover these things. You know, Tim.
All the connections.
Yes, the roots. And
Interesting.
So it wasn't like moving to a strange place and starting all over. There was family history already here for us. And there still are people living here who have that kind of history with the place, but not as many as there used to be, I think. I think that's part of the change that's happened. And the Art Association is flourishing and is much, much more active in terms of teaching and having exhibits. And I think it was a very small place, limited.
Small scale
place in the beginning, and mm-hmm. it's grown to be quite a sophisticated place that is one of the jewels, I think, in the community now. And
what does their public program look like? Their outreach?
They have a lot of classes.
Mm-hmm. I've taken some. They have films, art films, and they have excursions. We've been to St. Louis with the Art Association, a trip they took, and they've taken many, many other.
They occasionally sponsor trips.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they have a high school awards program. They invite submissions from high school kids. One of our granddaughters had something in a photograph.
Well, they were chosen.
They were
selected from...
By the art teachers.
I'm not sure how they were selected. Maybe by the art teachers.
They provide a venue for
high school art.
Yes. I think it's going on right now toward the end of the school year. Mm-hmm. And, we had a granddaughter. We weren't really aware of it until our granddaughter had two photographs that she'd taken after a photography class she had. And they were chosen to hang in the Art Association.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
so it's an institution well worth supporting and very lively now. It's really mm-hmm. going strong.
Mm-hmm. We feel it's really important to support all these institutions in Concord, even if we don't use them that much or have that much. That's one thing
that we've
been able to do.
Mm-hmm.
The orchestra, the Art Association, the church, of course, the library.
Yeah,
Tim has donated in his mother's name. Well, his mother did move nearby, in her final years, and she's a tremendous reader. And he donated to help with the renovation of the West Concord Library, and also here the children's room. I think there's a plaque.
Yeah, has her name on it. Yeah, and also there are lots of other multitude of organizations in this town volunteer. Like there's an organization that has a building called the Scout House, and they have square dances and other activities there, and we contributed to when part of the floor was about to collapse, we contributed to the renovation of that, and then the Friends of the Performing Arts in Concord has its own structure where the Concord Orchestra plays, and they put on amateur plays. That's over on Walden Street, and we support that with a donation every year, and we've done other things to help out.
We've supported the Concord Chorus. I've sung in the Concord Chorus a couple of times over the years for a period of time.
What kind of music?
Large works. I sang Brahms Requiem with
Brahms Sherman Requiem, yeah.
Once. And they're still going. They're still performing a couple of times a year. They usually do a very nice Christmas performance in the Episcopal Church. And I'm really, it really feels very good to be able to support the local things. We do give money to places beyond the town,
the town runs really on volunteer work, like this library, to a large extent. Yeah.
So we contribute to things like the campaign for the library, and just because it's really important to us to see this place to thrive and continue on into the future. So we're kind of committed to Concord in that way.
Indeed.
As an idea as much as cluster of creativity or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say there is a lot to do with the arts here. The Concord Players. We go to the Concord Players. Well, if you judge some of these things by other standards, maybe they're not, Broadway.
Yeah. One reason why Concord's become a desirable place to live, and it's in increased real estate values and led to a boutique-filled center and so on, is that Concord has a sense of community, I think, that a lot of towns around here lack. And so people want to hang on to that. I notice Concord Museum has been revitalized recently, and I think partly by newer people who come into town who have money and are willing to support it and get involved in their activities. And the museum now is a very bright place. It's got a lot going on, whereas when we moved here, it was pretty small and rather dull, I think. So while Concord has changed, partly because newer, younger people have moved in with a lot of money, it's also had its benefits, I think. An infusion of interest, which has helped the arts particularly.
Mm-hmm. People do move here for the schools.
Yeah. And the schools have active arts in the school?
No, I would say they're classified as good schools in the ratings of schools outside of Boston. Concord people have moved here because the schools were good in general. not necessarily because of the arts. It is sort of a different. But so there have been a lot of changes, really. I mean, you don't often stop to think about that. But since we moved here, there have been a lot.
Can you give us some more brushstrokes about the Locke Country Store? You've mentioned penny candy and nice clothes.
And sports clothes. They did sports clothes. And
Who designed those?
They would contract with. Yeah, right.
They did.
Yeah.
I'm not really.
Would go down to New York and various places.
On buying trips.
They made bow ties. You can't get a bow tie anymore. I still wear bow ties, but they had neat bow ties, slender bow ties in those days, which were kind of a relic of old Ivy League, I guess.
It was really oriented towards sports clothes. As I say, shirts and pants and button down shirts they used to have. I mean, it's changed now, but when button down shirts were in preppy, that was one of the preppy things with the button down shirt. They had sweaters. They always had nice wool sweaters from
Shetland Isles.
Yeah, probably from the British Isles. They didn't have. I don't think they carried outerwear particularly, or did they?
I don't think so. No,
I don't remember that they did. It wasn't a large store, but they had children's things and men's, women's. But the penny candy, every child in town knew the penny candy.
Yeah.
And there was a woman who presided who made sure that the children did it right.
Behaved. Mrs. Nichols.
Mrs. Nichols. And our children still talk about how they rode their bikes down there to the penny candy store and spent their money, and how Mrs. Nichols would make them hold the bag, and she'd put things in they weren't supposed to grab. And they still joke about it. It's one of their memories of Concord.
Growing up, yeah.
Is that spelled like the coin, or C-H-O-L?
Yeah, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, I think. Yeah.
Yes. And she was a fixture there. It was right inside the front door, the penny candy. And they had wonderful boxes that you could buy for your family full of penny candy. And anyone who knew the country store would remember that.
They had a mail order business. They had a very engaging catalog with the well-known cartoonist doing some drawings. And so they sent that around. So they had a decent mail order business as well as retail here.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds pretty imaginative for the time.
It was, yeah. Well,
was
that your aunt?
Becky's uncle.
Was that your aunt?
Becky's uncle Bill Locke did a very good job in managing it.
He ran it, but it was begun by my aunt's father, Philip Trumbull.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't Philip Trumbull, was it?
No, Philip was another.
Yeah. Can't remember his
Trumbull.
Name.
I didn't know him, but it was his idea, and they kept it going the same way, the sports clothes, generally speaking. And they may have had winter jackets and things of that sort, too. I don't remember. Shoes, they may have had shoes. I
don't think so.
Because we didn't live here then.
Was the store operational when you came to live in 68?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Still operational.
And until what year? Did
Well, the 80s, was it?
80s.
when Bill died and Mary, I don't remember, it must have been about the 80s.
I'll say it's probably around the 1980s. Yeah. And then it's a furniture store, place you'd go to look for things for your home.
Next to the Colonial Inn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I also, there was a store next to the country store, which was the clothing store. What was the name of that? It was a women's clothing store. They had a lot of nice things. They had dressy things. What was its name?
I don't remember.
Search my memory. Someone would remember. And I still have clothing that I bought there. I wish they were still here, as a matter of fact. Oh, it was a yarn shop. It was called the Yarn Shop, wasn't it? Or the Wool Shop.
Wool Shop.
That was it, the Wool Shop. And they sold yarns, patterns for knitting, and then women's clothes. That was it. Hmm. And actually, one of my cousins is married to a woman who started it. But she's not related to me, really. There always seem to be connections like that with things, people in Concord. So now that's shop. It had an upstairs, and I don't know who lived upstairs or whether people did live upstairs or what went on upstairs. But it is now a B&B. It's the
Northbridge
Inn. Mm-hmm. And it's run by a young cousin of mine.
An Emerson?
No.
She was a Locke cousin through the Locke family. And, her mother, her father has just died, George Senkler. He ran a lumber store.
Concord Lumber.
Mm-hmm. And I guess his father-in-law owned it. And then he took it over and ran that for many, many years. And this is one of his daughters who now runs the Northbridge Inn, which is a B&B. B&B.
And it's above the Wool Shop or above the country store?
It's next door to the country store, and it's above what was the Wool Shop.
It's
right down the street from the Colonial Inn. The
country store isn't called the country store anymore, is it?
No, it's got another name now. So, the more I remember, the more I see there are family members of some sort, extended family members, everywhere in Concord. I know my grandmother was the president of the Concord League of Women Voters at one time. And
what did she do in that capacity? Any idea?
No, I don't know. I know she was, as president, she ran meetings, I suppose, and
encouraged people to vote, as the league still does.
I wonder what the issues of the day would have been.
Yes, I wonder. I don't really know.
Women's suffrage, but I think that predated the League of Women Voters.
They moved here in 1911. My grandparents did. So they would have been here during women's suffrage.
That's right. Yeah.
And my grandmother lived in this large brick house that belonged to the Middlesex School. And they had six children, lived in the two lower floors, which were arranged like a house. regular house, pretty good size. And then, but there was another floor above, which housed young boys who went to the school. Boarders. It was a boarding school. Probably was a day school then, too, which it is today, also boarding and day. Now, of course, it's co-ed. Mm-hmm. But, and my mother and father were married in the chapel at Middlesex. Very lovely chapel out there. And one of my aunts met her husband at my mother and father's wedding. They were also married there. So, but I think my mother, my grandmother, as I say, had six children and also was house mother to some young boys. I think it was eighth grade through high school.
Yeah, which was an onerous job as well as raising a family. So she sent her three daughters out to St. Paul.
Well.
Not all at once.
One by one.
One by one. And they all married St. Paul boys, met and married St. Paul boys, including Becky's father.
Yeah, my great-grandparents had moved out to St. Paul in the 1880s, and so they would send, this family would send a daughter out to spend the winter and go to school, and they were all about 16 or 17 or so, and they all met their husbands, yeah, in St. Paul, which is how I happened to grow up there.
Interesting.
Well.
The diaspora, how it'll... Mm. Settle on one distant place, and lots of people go there.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think Concord has always felt like home to me. From the day we moved here, I never felt... It took a long while to make friends, of course, meet a lot of people, but there was something about being here that was always felt right. And I think I would have been unhappy moving to a place like Lincoln or...
God forbid, Lexington.
Or some of the other Lexington. We started, when we were looking for a house in Concord, the aunt who helped run the country store, I said one day, well, we're looking in Concord, and we thought we'd look in Lexington, too. No, no, she said. You don't want to go to Lexington. So that was...
So we went to Acton.
We got that, we got that message.
Well, you'll have to direct us a little bit at this point. What have we failed to... Ask you what did you really come here to talk about? I guess that's the question.
You're doing great.
Well, we were asked.
I just don't want to.
We don't want to miss an area. No. Maybe
I don't
the
want to eclipse any important stories or details.
You once served on the town committee. We haven't done much with the town in terms of serving on committees or boards. But we've done it.
I served on the committee that organized the bicentennial in 1975.
It was a big celebration.
A big celebration.
The President of the United States, who was...
It was Gerald Ford then.
Gerald Ford came and spoke. That turned the town upside down, actually.
At the old North Bridge, he came.
And huge celebration. Mm-hmm. The bicentennial.
Yeah. You had the impetus there of the Park Service too, right?
Had they
gotten fairly well rolling on what they?
Well, they helped organize it and did the crowd control,
there was a camp out. I remember
the camp out. Yeah, this is hippie era, and there was a camp out by the old North Bridge.
Oh my goodness!
A lot of people came in with their guitars and marijuana and so on, and we're having a good time.
Well, there was a certain amount of anxiety.
I think the Park Service probably kept things quiet there. Our son, who was then, he was born, he was 12.
He was about 12.
12. And he and a friend went over to see what was going on at the this camp out, and then they got tired and they didn't want to go home, so they went by a Salvation Army container where people would put clothes there donating to Salvation Army. So Jeff and Clay McGrath climbed in there, slept there several hours, and then went back to the celebration in the early morning. Didn't even come back for breakfast, I think. Anyway, so
that was that elicit some concern from the parents?
Well, yeah, we wondered
but we had given permission.
Yeah,
we thought. Well,
we didn't expect
it's any. Safe enough out there. There are all kinds of people patrolling, and
you might be more hesitant now than to.
Right. We might. Anyway, so that was a big deal for Concord. Yeah, have the president come in by helicopter. There's a picture with our minister who greeted him and did a prayer right by the president by the Old North Bridge.
Were there any issues to resolve in the committee? You know, how do you present this big piece of history? Or
what was that?
I was involved in the publications part of it, so I wasn't in the head committee.
There's a lot to publicizing this, though, and what to say.
Yeah,
now,
we put together a brochure and so on. Yeah.
You had a booklet.
Yeah, a booklet.
But you're an accomplished editor and writer yourself.
Yeah,
and
that's why I was on the committee. That committee, I've been a lot more active in the church than I have in town affairs.
I was going to say the church has been something that both of us have been involved in since the beginning. We of moving here. I have a mixed background religiously. My father was Presbyterian. My mother was Unitarian, and I'm also connected with some very early Unitarians who were prominent in Boston through my mother's side of the family. And all the Eastern stuff is through my mother's side of the family. And
Eastern stuff.
Well, all the Eastern relatives in Concord, and then the Eastern Unitarian ministers and where we summered on the Cape Cod, and that was all my mother's side of the family, through my mother's side of the family. But I was christened in the Unitarian Church. They don't call it christening anymore, as was Tim. We had both been christened in the same church and in St. Paul. And we were married there. I actually went to Sunday school in the Presbyterian Church. But we sort of together chose the Unitarian route. And when we came here, we went pretty quickly down to the church and it was important for us to find a place where we could connect our whole family as a family and connect with other families. And so we became churchgoers fairly. And the church itself has always been kind of an important building in town, one of the most important buildings. It has a history. It housed Harvard. Was it Harvard?
Yeah, Harvard during the Revolutionary War.
During the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, for a while.
Harvard moved out there. Yeah. Out and
Harvard
and,
University?
Yeah. Yeah. And used the church, the college. And it was established in 1635. So it's a really, really one of the oldest.
It was founded some of the founders of the town were people connected with the, helped found the Unitarian Church. And for many years, the all the town meetings and the town business was held in the church.
Till about
church, the church and the government were synonymous, really.
Till about 1880.
Yeah.
1850.
50?
Well, sometime in the 1800s, yeah, the town and the church split. But they were one thing with two different programs, so to speak. Church and town government.
Wasn't that a role usually taken on by the congregational churches in New England?
Well, this is a congregational church. Congregational means is really refers to the kind of polity, that is the kind of governance of the church. It's got a, in a way, it has a small c. The congregational churches were originally, ours was a was one of the early Puritan, I guess you'd call it a, the Puritan churches, with a congregational polity.
That is, they didn't have bishops who would appoint ministers. They, the congregation itself appointed the ministers.
Would choose ministers. Yeah. Fire ministers.
So it was a local governance.
It was local governance.
Hierarchical governance.
It was not hierarchical. One of the reasons that some people came to this country was to escape the hierarchical Church of England. And there was a, well, there's a lot of history here, but basically it grew out of a movement to get away from that, and it was brought to this country with the earliest settlers on the East Coast. Plymouth, for instance, had that sort of church. Plymouth was, the Plymouth original settlers in Plymouth were separatists, and they were sort of a group unto themselves. The group, the people that came here settled up and down the coast, the Massachusetts coast, and then spread out. There was another group, of course, that went to the south. But those who came to Massachusetts established these congregational churches. Now, it's called a parish, which is actually comes from England. The churches there in England, there were parish, I think, was the main boundary line between separation line, and towns would exist within the parish. And it was true here, too, for a while. It's changed. But anyway, Concord was an early church. Peter Buckley was a very renowned minister. In 1825, a group split off from the church here and in all the other churches in the eastern part of Massachusetts. There was a split. By this time, there were people who no longer believed in the Trinity, but one God was what they espoused. The idea that
a unity.
One God. So there was a unity here rather than a trinity. There were a group of people in 1825 who wanted to retain the Trinity as the focus, theological focus, and they asked permission to leave the church and went across the brook and founded what is now the Congregational, First Congregational Church of Concord. It's a Trinitarian Congregational Church of Concord. And among them was Thoreau's family. Henry David Thoreau's mother and sister were in that group. Mm-hmm. And it was a small group, and they went. So this happened in all of the churches. There was a split. Some of the old churches with the older buildings. Of course, our building has burned and been rebuilt a couple of times. With the older buildings, some of them became Unitarian, became Unitarian, and some of them became Trinitarian churches, specifically. Now, at the very top of our steeple, there's a three-pronged trident?
Trident.
Like a big fork or a
spear.
With three, at the very tip-top like of
Neptunes.
Our steeple. And that's the only symbol left of the Trinitarian beliefs, which were there originally. So that was 1825. So for 200, well, not quite
and
200
then the
years.
Congregationalists some time ago merged with the Dutch Reformed Church.
Yeah.
To form what it was. I slipped my mind right now.
Well, the United Church of Christ. The United Church of Christ are called the Congregationalists, with a big C. But the governance is the same, more or less. I mean, it's
so interesting, and it makes me wonder too about contemporary issues. You know, how it sounds like it's a very vibrant church.
What issues have
you struggled with and dealt with in modern days?
It's one of the largest Unitarian Universalist churches in the country. There are about how many?
700.
The large churches, the largest churches in our denomination, but it's one of the very largest ones, which is surprising because of the small town, relatively small town that it is in. It's had very powerful ministers through the years, and was Ralph Waldo was never a minister here.
No, he stayed away mostly.
Yeah, and he criticized at one point Ralph Waldo Emerson criticized the minister.
Minister named Barzilai Frost. And,
there's and a famous
Emerson,
sermon.
Emerson came to hear him a couple times and thought he was so boring that he stayed away thereafter. He urged the standing committee to get rid of
him. This budding transcendentalism that he was espousing had no link with these other things.
No.
Clear
I don't know if other people you've talked to have talked about the founding of the town, have they?
Well, we've heard them say that they couldn't make it through the first winter; they had to go back to Boston.
In the early 1600s, of course, Boston was very alarmed because of Indian raids in Massachusetts and Rhode Island and so on, and there are quite a long history of that, King Philip's War and so on. And so they decided to found some towns ringing Boston in order to protect Boston from Indian raids. And Concord was the first one of them, and the general court, that is the legislature, granted, I can't remember how many square miles to anybody who would come out here and settle. And a group did that, led by Peter Bulkley, the minister who was my ancestor, and another minister, and other people who were founders of the town. And then Woburn, northeast of here, was the second town created by fiat by the legislature. I want to say add something to what I don't think you mentioned it, but in midlife, Becky went to Harvard Divinity School and became a minister, and she was graduated in 1889 and was ordained in 1893. So she became
I was ordained here, had a service of ordination. That was pretty special, something I never dreamed would happen. I worked as a chaplain at Mass General Hospital for a while, and in nursing homes in Boston, did ministry with the elderly to some extent, and I was coming in at a time when the Unitarian Universalists had been talking about forming a second category of ministry called community ministry. And I was one of the first ones. It was a little tentative and didn't have much stature. So it's developed further now and is a little more accepted and structured.
Tell them what a community minister
is. A community minister is a person who goes out from the church and does work within the community. And my understanding of it is that because you're a part of this church, that somehow you can bring back to the church something of the outside community. For instance, when people came to I'm getting ahead. But at any rate, but I was asked to come to be an assistant to the minister here in 1985.
Yeah, about that.
Mm-hmm. When did Dana die? Dana Greeley died.
You were ordained in 90.
I was ordained in 91. Okay, it was about 1995.
Yeah.
In about 1995, I was asked to come by the minister, whose assistant had suddenly resigned in September, and it's already a big church and definitely needed two ministers. So he asked if I'd come, and I didn't preach, which was fine with me. I participated in all of the worship services, did prayers and readings, and I did the pastoral work of the church and sort of formed the first pastoral ministry there. Pastoral ministry is, of course, caring for those who are perhaps members of the community who are experiencing an illness or who have had a grief, have a person in their family who died, and presiding at weddings, and presiding at weddings and memorial services was one thing that I did in that capacity, and visiting people who were in nursing homes or long-term care facilities or the hospital, I trained a group of volunteers to be friendly visitors. There had been a group there, but we sort of reactivated it. And eventually they hired a full-time associate minister. And they kept me on as a very part-time pastoral minister. There wasn't much money in the budget, but that was something I hadn't expected to do after I was where I expected to go somewhere else. But there weren't jobs for a pastoral minister. You had to sort of...
Well, you did work in hospitals and nursing homes. So.
But I did a lot of volunteer work in long-term care, with long-term care and facilities. So now I'm not involved. I'm retired.
Good.
From that, and have been for a while, and try to stay out of the way. So I think Tim and I have headed up about every important committee in the church there is. We've done...
What are some others?
The standing committee, it's an old term, is are the church leaders.
Governing board.
governing board. It used to be 6, and now it's 12.
11.
The minister is chosen, relates to the standing committee, and the standing committee really oversees the governance of the church. And this is what made it unique in its founding. The minister, of course, has full control of the pulpit. I say control, that's and what happens in the worship services, and does a lot more too, and advises the standing committee. They work together, and then there are a lot of committees.
So we both
for fundraising and
chairs of the standing
committee. We've both been chairs of that standing committee.
Been heads of search
board. It's another name for board.
Various other nominating committees.
We've done fundraising.
Fundraising. I ran fundraising a couple times way back.
So it's been, I mean, I think if you count all of the people in the church who are identified in any way with the church, there have been 1,000, at least 1,000, that included children and families, and which is a large church for this area, and the largest church in Concord. And it's been a very influential church. We have a very strong record of
promoting social justice.
Social justice mm-hmm. work.
Can you talk about that?
Well, let's see.
Well, we have a sister church in Hungary, and we've been very active in supporting that. It's a poor church, and we've been over there a lot, various groups. I was one of the first people to go over back in the early 90s, I guess. And we support them and send people over, like the choir and other people, organizational.
And now people are hitched up with students, and we pay a certain fee for them to be able to go to the high school because it costs them money. And
so you have student exchange.
We have student exchange.
Right.
Yes,
groups
it's
the church
a very organized program.
Gone down
now.
After
it's
Katrina,
grown.
They went down and did some rebuilding.
Youth and groups have gone out to work.
And 15% of our budget goes toward social justice work.
Social responsibility is the word I would like to. Social responsibility, really. Some of it's sort of justice work. Others is more relief kind of work.
Relief,
People more or less bring something in, and then the group will, adopt a certain program. Some of them are temporary. Some of them are long running. We have an open table at our church, which doesn't exactly come under the aegis of the committee, but it's the kind of, a part of what we are as a church, opening our doors every Thursday night to a community dinner.
And people who are not well off.
Yeah.
And they provide food.
It's not run by the church.
Yeah.
But
ready.
The open table is a town. Really a town.
Well, it's an area function.
An area function.
They go other towns other nights of the week. And on Thursday nights, our church is host to a group of, a couple hundred, I would say, come in and get supplies, get food.
I don't know.
And have a meal.
It's maybe a lot. Yeah. But it's not run by the church, but it is supported because we allow the facility and the kitchen. They take over the kitchen. They have their own storage area. And
we have the best kitchen.
We have a very fine kitchen.
In town of any church.
Sought after.
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, the most complete kitchen and largest. And not the best, I suppose. But
our
anyway.
Our ministers.
Very good.
have been active in events beyond the realm of the church. For instance, when there was the events in Selma, Alabama, which were just commemorated, one of the ministers of the church was there, and that's and an organizer of a group of ministers who went down. So
and a Unitarian minister was killed, not from our church, but
was actually killed in that
one of the Unitarian ministers.
That Selma, March. We have movie films and educational things. We are a welcoming church, which means we welcome people of all persuasions. So we say.
Those who are not persuaded, too.
But that, by that, gay, lesbian, transgender people.
How did your congregation deal with adopting that position?
Well, it was it came down from the central Unitarian headquarters. And we had educational programs about it. I don't think it was a big, issue.
Eased into it, actually. Our current minister is gay.
And we can say that because it was very public.
Yeah,
openly.
And the vote to call him was, how many, 500 or so?
99% or
yay and one nay. And it was because of his
orientation.
So there was an educational program to bring people along and raise awareness?
Yes, this was some years ago now.
It came very easily because members of our church are liberal and accepting anyway. I don't really remember any big organized campaign.
It was talked about more openly just recently when we hired a gay minister.
Yeah.
And it really was out there in the open.
Yeah, it really wasn't an issue.
And I think that was the first time it had been so openly discussed. But some years ago, we became there was a name for it.
A welcoming
congregation. And the whole church didn't vote on it. I think a smaller group did, but it was with the blessing of the congregation.
So you didn't lose a lot of members over that?
No.
I think the only time I'm aware of members being lost was really just before we came, and it was over the Vietnam War. Because the minister at the time gave many sermons about the evils of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And some members got up and went to Carlisle and walked out and went to Carlisle at the time.
Including
the
some
Unitarian
big financial
church.
Supporters of the church. Of course, the church was very small then, about, maybe 200, 250 members.
250.
Yeah.
300. Yeah.
In the late 60s.
Yeah, so that was the last thing I can remember. The most difficult times we've had are in transitions after a minister leaves. Every church has transitions. We've just had a huge one. And it's very difficult. But we had help from the headquarters. I mean, we're a decentralized church, but we do have a headquarters, and they provide services for us.
Headquarters in Boston.
In Boston, the Unitarian Universalist Association. We merged in the 1960s, too, with the Universalist Church, which was a very small, dwindling church. And there are some buildings that were owned built by the Universalists, some of our churches. Church buildings, and the denomination voted to merge, and that's how we became Unitarian Universalist. It's kind of a mouthful.
Big mouthful, yeah.
Or UU, as people.
UU.
Yeah, UU. Right.
That's what they say, UU.
Did that bring a change?
Well, the Unitarians were much larger in number than the Universalists, and some of the amiability and love that the Universalists preached got lost, I think. Unitarians tend to be intellectual.
More intellectual.
And, yeah. And so it's become often an organization of units that are intellectual, that are usually humanist, who don't preach any presence of God, for instance, and Jesus is a secondary figure.
But they're there under our umbrella.
Yeah, it's a big umbrella.
This is the Unitarians you're talking about?
Unitarian Universalist Association. Universalists were a dwindling, as Becky says, a dwindling group, mostly in small towns in upstate New York.
It was a very rural.
Very rural and a very simple, direct approach to theology and preaching God is love, really. Many Unitarian organizations, especially outside of New England, are strictly humanist and often church services are become very intellectual and rather dry, in my opinion, and without much love expressed.
You can get into a lot of ethics, though, without necessarily talking about love.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They become ethical considerations, which, you know,
which is
terrific.
It's
important.
But you add love, and it's dry.
Yeah, and there's
love has always been there, but
a growing humanist group in our church now, run by a very energetic fellow who is really.
It's run by several energetic fellows now.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Several energetic fellows. Are they all fellows?
Yes, they are.
They're all guys. I can't think of any females.
They're all men.
Females got better sense.
I'm sure there are.
This is to say that a Unitarian, big, large Unitarian church like ours is not a homogeneous group theologically, necessarily.
Yeah.
It used to be when we first came. Now, when we first came, it was very clearly you can talk about the Christian Unitarians. There is a group, Christian Unitarians, which is still around. King's Chapel in Boston was Christian Unitarian. A couple of churches outside Boston were really Christian Unitarian and may still be today. Our church never was. It was more middle of the road. We were all Christian churches until a certain point. But then it began to change in the 1800s and in the 1900s and evolved. Now, it's an umbrella of beliefs.
Well, there's no creed.
There's
to
no
subscribe to, so you can.
It's open ended.
Easily come in, but easily drop out. And some young families join because they want their children to have a religious education, and then after they finish high school, they haven't had much interest in the church anyway, so they just drop out.
But in some ways, we're probably a sort of a melting pot theologically. which is an interesting thing about it. And this is a very big church and draws from the surrounding community, even though there are Unitarian groups. People do come from away. Mm-hmm. And the church has been a center for people to meet in Concord from the early days.
This has been great. I mean, you two clearly have so much more you could be saying. No, it's good. Don't make the talky faces.
But you don't know that you know what you know, in a way.
Yeah.
If somebody says, I want to interview you, it's like,
You think you have nothing to say.
Well,
so much.
About what?
Yeah. You know, set us going, and it's hard to stop us.
So that's an interesting...
This might be a good wind-up spot for today, do you think?
I think so, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm fascinated. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Have you been interviewing a lot of people in Concord?
We've been doing this.